This session is on preserving local food, and this is from the Eat Local Project, which is sponsored by the Cochise County Library District. And we're in a webinar format, so everyone right now is muted and cameras are off. But if you have questions and you want to grab the microphone toward the end, we can do that. But in general, if you use the chat for any conversation you want to have, and if you have specific questions for the presenters, put that in the Q&A or you can put it in the chat. And we are also live streaming this to Facebook. So for people who are joining us on Facebook, feel free to post questions there and we will get to as many of those as we can as well. So I want to just give a quick overview of this project. I know we have some new people on the webinar tonight. We've been doing a series of webinars. So we have on the eatlocalcochise.org website, we have archived versions of all of the webinars we've done in the past, things about where to get local food, growing and gardening, and a variety of other topics. Cooking was our last one. We also have a big read coming up in June, and we'd like to invite everybody to read the book Animal Vegetable Miracle by Barbara Kingsolver, which is a lovely book about eating local. We have directories of local food producers and markets on our website. We have a ton of books in all of our 12 county and city library branches in the county. And I'll talk about more about some of those specifically related to our topic tonight. And just a lot of good resources. This picture on the screen is of a school kit. So if there's anybody watching who is either a teacher or homeschools, we have a kit with about 30 books for kids that you can check out, teachers' guides, activities, just all kinds of information. So you can ask at your local library in Cochise County about that. And I am going to just introduce our speakers tonight and turn it over to them. So my name is Karen Fassenpower. I'm the project manager for Eat Local. And also with us tonight, we have Cynthia Aspengren, who is with the University of Arizona Cooperative Extension, and we're happy to have her here. She is a canning and food safety and all things food preserving expert. And we also have BJ Searcy, who is with BASA, which is the Baja Arizona Sustainable Agriculture Group. And BJ will also be with us to talk about foraging in 2 weeks. So we are excited about that. So with that, I am going to turn it over to Cynthia and BJ to get started.
Well, good evening, everybody. I'm so glad you could be here. I'm going to chat a minute while I set up the screen to share. So hopefully you all can see my big sort of salmon colored screen. So glad you're here. BJ is probably the bigger expert on canning than I am. She's been doing it a lot longer, but we did take a class together to get certified as master food preservers. So we're excited to have you here. And why don't we just go ahead and get started? So food preservation, how and why. This is going to be the short and sweet version because we can't teach you everything you need to know in an hour. But we're going to hopefully, if I can say the pun, whet your appetites to teach you, to make you more interested in learning how to do this. That is why we are here.
Okay, so why do we preserve food? When it's done properly, it prolongs the shelf life of the food. You can harvest. You can keep it for longer than what it stays in the refrigerator. It keeps us, makes it safe to eat and keeps its nutrition. And it saves us money. If you go to the store, compare what seeds cost and what it costs to open up a jar of your homegrown vegetables, you'll find that you've saved a lot of money.
And other reasons we preserve food. It extends the shelf life of that food. Think about all that food that we have in the grocery store that's in cans. It can be on your shelf for years. Whereas if we try to save it in our refrigerator, we get a week or two before it starts to lose its appeal to us. And so it helps us avoid food waste. When we do it properly, it's going to maintain a safe and nutritious product for us. Food safety is a big deal when we're talking about canning, but it's also going to help maintain that nutrition because it keeps it in a situation where it's just going to maintain its nutrition. We'll lose a little over time, but not enough to worry about. And as BJ already said, it saves us money.
Well, there's different ways to preserve food. The easiest one is freezing food, and almost everything can be frozen. There's some instances where it tastes better if it's not frozen, if it's canned or dried or otherwise. The most common is canning, and there's specific things and serious guidelines on that, on what you can do canning-wise, whether it be a boiling water bath or if it can be done in a pressure canner.
Fermenting is fairly new to me, and boy, I don't know why I didn't start sooner. Fermenting has been around for hundreds of years. Two of the most common foods that we think of as fermented foods are kimchi and sauerkraut. But there's lots of other things that we can ferment, and there's a couple of different ways to ferment. Dehydrating. In this picture, I've got the handy dandy little dehydrating machine. You know, they run anywhere between $60 and you can buy a really expensive one for, you know, upwards of $200. But you can also dehydrate in your stove or in a solar cooker. Many different ways to dehydrate. So here we are. How do we dehydrate? Look at this very simple dehydration process here. They've got one of those plastic covers that you can buy at Target or Walmart on a pizza tray or small pizza pan or on top of a black enameled pan. And it's just sitting out in the sun. And we need those little aerators there, the holes in there, to make sure that the moisture escapes while we're dehydrating the food. The second picture is it's one of the more expensive commercial dehydrators. And they can run $150 to $200. You get a lot more in that dehydrator. And it actually has to run for a shorter amount of time to dehydrate that food. This is one of the lower cost dehydrators. And again, your oven. And I apologize for not having all that written in there. BJ, I think I stepped on your toes, so go for it.
That's fine. It followed right along. For when we do freezing, the first thing you need is fresh food, and you clean it, make sure it's very clean. You get rid of all of your stems, your pieces of flowers and all of that stuff, and cut it up and prepare it for the table, basically. Most foods, you'll have to blanch it, and that the blanching is very often misunderstood. Blanch it, you actually count the time that you need to blanch it from the time it starts to boil after you've put the food in. Then you pull it out after when the time is done, and you immediately place in an ice water to immediately chill it. Quite easy to do, but quite often you'll get people that start the time after it's been boiling for 5 minutes and then they start counting the time, or you'll get people that start counting the time before it actually comes back to a boil. But it's that easy enough to do. Once it's cooled down, put it in containers, seal it so that it doesn't get freezer burnt, and put it in the freezer, and you can use it for a year.
Okay. And I see questions there, and I promise we'll get to them at the end of the presentation if that is okay with people. I am paying attention to the questions and writing them down. So how do we ferment? So we want to choose the produce that we're going to ferment. Again, I mentioned kimchi and I mentioned sauerkraut, but there are other things. We've made fermented mango salsa. One of my people did, and it was delicious. So we can ferment many different things. We're either going to choose a brine process where we create the brine that's going to draw out the chemicals from the food that we're fermenting, or we can actually just use our hands and press out the juices from the produce to, so as long as we get enough of the juice pressed out of there, the salt has to be the right amount with the weight of the produce. So it also helps draw the juice out and starts that fermenting process with the lactic acid in the produce. Depending on what you're fermenting and how long you want to ferment for until you get just the right texture of your whatever you're fermenting, we want to ferment for a few days and then refrigerate to stop the fermentation process. If we let it continue to ferment and we don't have a place to keep it cool, then it'll just keep fermenting and we'll lose a lot of the lovely texture that we like with those fermented vegetables or whatever produce you're doing.
Now, this is my particular area of expertise is canning.
Yes.
When I was a little girl, I lived on a farm up in Colorado, and our neighborhood would get together and can truckloads of produce that one of the farmers would go out and get peaches from the Western Slope or whatever, and they would bring it in. We would bring the kids in, all of the adults started out. So I started canning when I was too small to actually see on top of the table unless I was standing on a chair. So the one that most people are familiar with is the water bath, boiling water bath for the high acid food. The cutoff for that is 4.6% acidity. If it's more alkaline than that, it needs to be pressure canned. The tomatoes are the one that you most normally think of being high acidic, but so are fruits and your jellies, juices, fruit juices, things like that. And with tomatoes, you need to add a little bit of acidity by vinegar or citric acid or lemon juice. Pressure canning, most people are afraid of it. There's nothing to be afraid of. If you follow the rules, you'll never have a problem. I've done this for 60 years, so I'm kind of thinking it's pretty safe. If you join our classes on pressure canning, we can go through that. And because you don't have the acidity to kill the bacteria, you need to pressure can. Just because great grandma used to do everything in a boiling water bath, or she turned her jars over when they were hot and the jar is sealed, does not mean you got rid of all of the pathogens that were inside. And you'll end up with canned food that doesn't take up freezer space and tastes delicious, and you'll have the control of what is in it. My husband is on a very low salt diet, and you can't buy no salt vegetables. It's just low salt, and he needs no salt. So I don't add salt to my canning, and that solves that problem.
Okay, so why do we do it? We've mentioned this twice already, and we're going to mention it again, because it saves money. If you have planted this huge garden and you don't know what to do with that food, I mean, it's nice to give it away to friends and neighbors and family members, but if it sits there and rots, then you've wasted time and money. If you buy a bunch of produce and it sits in your refrigerator and you end up not eating that produce and it goes bad, you're wasting money. So when we get this produce in large quantities, maybe you get it from a food bank and you choose the best of the best to can, you're going to save money. And in the long run, you're going to save money from shopping at the store. Again, we maintain that nutrition. When we can food, we lose a little bit of nutrition, but it's not significant enough for us to worry about between canned foods and fresh foods. And it, again, it reduces that food waste. United States, oh my gosh, we waste a lot of food in this country. A lot of it because people don't know how to prepare food. They get foods that they don't know what these foods are. And because we've lost the skill of preserving food. So reducing that food waste is really important. It saves us money, maintains that nutrition, reduces food waste. It also makes us more food secure. When the pandemic hit, the shelves were empty. But people who are able to preserve that food already had the food on the shelves. So it helps us avoid that food insecurity that some of us might have, especially if we live in what we call food deserts, where there's not a grocery store close. And you decide you want to make that special dinner, and it's a 45-minute drive one way to the grocery store. This way you've got the food already on your shelf or in your freezer.
And of course, you get to add the ingredients that you want, and you've raised it yourself. So of course, it's a lot more delicious than if you buy something that you've never tried before, and you're not really sure what's in the, you can read the ingredients list, but are you sure? And so you know what is in it. So it's obviously delicious. And you get a little pride off of the fact that you did it yourself.
Absolutely. It's delicious, nutritious. BJ mentioned that her husband has to have a specific diet. People who have allergens, either they have them or their family has them. This is a great way to avoid those allergens because nothing has been added that you don't want in there. We need to remember to be food safe. Factory canned food has not been a problem for any foodborne outbreaks for a very long time, since around the 1950s. But home canned products, there have been some foodborne illness outbreaks with home canned products. So we need to make sure that we're following these really simple rules. Clean everything before you use it. Absolutely. Separate those things that should not, so we can avoid cross-contamination. If you've got a cutting board where you're cutting up the meat that you're getting ready to use for some meal, we don't want to use that same cutting board to cut up vegetables because we could have cross-contamination. And we don't want to get in that bad habit. Even if everything is going in, you're going to cut it all up together, it's all going into your canning jars. We just don't want to get into that habit where we cut it all up on the same cutting board without washing, rinsing, and sanitizing in between. So making those habits stick. One cutting board for cutting up meats, one for cutting up chicken, one for cutting up fish, one for cutting up produce. We want to make sure we cook everything to its proper internal temperature. So regardless of whether we're preserving the food in water bath canning or pressure canning, or we're just cooking that food for our everyday meal, we need to make sure that we're cooking that food to its proper internal temperature to reduce the pathogens. And we want to chill that food in the way we're supposed to. So it's a little bit different. We're chilling the canned goods a little bit differently. We're just letting those sit in the open air in their jars to chill. But we really don't want to let foods that need to go in the refrigerator sit out for more than about 2 hours before we put it in the refrigerator. You don't want to put large amounts of warm food in your refrigerator because that's going to heat up the entire refrigerator and potentially cause problems for all the other food in there. But following these very simple steps for being food safe can make all the difference in the world. And this little picture is straight off the USDA food safety website. You can also find it in a website called Fight Back, BAC.
Okay, when you're doing any of the recipes, the canning, the freezing, the fermenting, don't change the recipe. In other words, if it says to use 1 inch of headspace and in the jars, and it says to cook it for an hour and 45 minutes, don't say, well, you know, it's been doing it pretty fast. I think I'll just go for an hour and a half. And I've got just a couple of tablespoons extra. I'm going to put it in the jar. It will change everything in there. The ingredients, you can leave out an ingredient, but you really can't add a whole bunch of different things. Or it's hard to explain that whole thing, but don't change everything. The recipes are all researched. Do it the proper time, the proper temperature. You need to use the proper herbs and spices. Most recipes will say what is optional and what is not optional. For instance, most recipes now say that salt is optional because there's a lot of people that have salt diets. My tongue's getting screwed up. And then adjust for your altitude. Recipes that are written in the books, ball canning jar is the one that we normally go by because it's well known and well researched. It will tell you how to adjust for altitude. For instance, for this area, you need to add 5 pounds pressure to a pressure canner. You need to add time to your boiling water baths. Make sure you adjust for that altitude because we're not at sea level by any means.
So if this has gotten you excited, we really hope that you can attend our online class on how to pressure can. We're talking with Cochise College about doing some classes in the fall to teach some fermentation and water bath canning classes there. So hopefully you are interested in learning from us. Maybe you're already doing this and it just helped sort of solidify some of the information. Please know that the science around all of this is changing. BJ mentioned this before, so that you might have done it one way or you've seen your family do it one way, but things have changed because we've learned more over time. So just be aware of what changes might be out there. I can send out a link to a free canning cookbook through the USDA it's a food preservation cookbook that talks about pressure canning, water bath canning, fermentation, and dehydration. So we can get that out to you as well. In fact, if everybody's good with me stopping to share, then I can look that link up right now and drop it in the chat.
That's great. Thanks, Cynthia. So we have a bunch of questions. I'm hearing a lot of feedback. I'm not sure. Okay, it's gone. I thought maybe we'd organize the questions by the different categories that you talked about, starting with drying. So we had a question about the different methods of dehydrating and particularly interest in the Walmart cake plastic thingy in the sun and just generally more information about how you can dehydrate in the sun. Like I know people who it's hot enough here. People who do, you know, clean plastic back of the truck bed with screening over it. So what are your thoughts about that, about dehydrating and the other inexpensive ways you can use the sun to dehydrate?
So BJ, didn't you make your own dehydrating thing?
Yes, I did. Out of a bed frame.
If you'll talk about that, well, I grab some things out of my kitchen to talk about the Walmart thing. That would be swell.
Okay. Yeah. Actually, I got the pattern from Rebecca Hildebrand, who's with the community garden in Sierra Vista. And you take a bed frame, or you can take a pallet, any kind of a box, wooden box frame. Then you take a black surface. I used weed cloth to start with on mine, underneath it to make a black reflector, a dark surface. And then I put screen on top of that to hold the food kind of above it. And then I took windows and put over the top of that to hold the heat in and to reflect it. And if anybody's ever stood underneath a piece of glass in the summertime, you know how warm it gets. It usually gets up to 150 to 160 degrees under that. That's how I started. I got it initially to dry my mesquite beans, because I could do a lot of mesquite beans that way, but I can also, and I have tried different fruits, just a little bit here and a little bit there to dry them with that. But it works quite well. If you happen to have a regular sun oven, you also can dehydrate in the sun oven using the solar.
And on solar, but also on oven, how long does it take to dry, or how do you know? I know it varies depending on the cut of the fruit and things. How do you know when it's dry enough to be dry?
Well, depends on what it is that you're trying to dry. I dried some bell peppers, for instance, and I wanted them dry enough that they were crisp, so that when I put them away, there was absolutely no moisture at all. You don't want to do it so long that it burns it. I guess that would be the kind of scorches it, because then you'll lose your taste of whatever it is. So you kind of have to keep an eye on it, what no matter what it is that you're trying to dry in the sun.
Yeah, Christy too says taste it. I worry if it's dry enough that I don't want any moisture. I think it's not too much of an issue here, but coming from back east, you know, you worry if there's just a little bit of moisture, is it going to mold? So somebody's asking, like, just ballpark, what are we talking about? Hours, days? What's the range?
Depends on the day and how much sun you can collect from it. If it's a slightly cloudy day, it may take all of one day. The bell peppers that I did, I had them in fairly small pieces so that it would dry a little faster. That helped. I had them chopped up. I didn't use like a half a pepper. I just used small pieces. And on a clear sunny day in direct sun, it took like 2 or 3 hours to get them down to where they were crisp. And other days, I did it. Okay. On a juicy vegetable, it would be a lot longer, maybe 12 hours from the sunset to sunrise to sunset. And if you can't get it done in one day, you need to put it in a dry area, put it in a, like I've got a shop, take it inside there, and then you would put them out the next day and finish it.
Good. Thank you.
So we were talking about the Walmart thing. So this is just one of those really basic microwave covers. You put it on your plate in the microwave. This is a smaller version. Then there's the bigger version that you might be more used to. And that picture was just the lid to an enameled pot. And they put the food right here on the lid. that on top, put it in the pan itself. And this pan is going to radiate heat. So if there's no moisture in the pan, it's going to help it dehydrate from the bottom and the top. Now, you could also use a pizza pan. I like this idea because it's up off the ground, and that's just my food safety thing that my world revolves around, is keeping food up off the ground. So very simple. You could even use the, if you can go to some nice pizza parlor and they give you the plastic, the cardboard on from the round thing for the pizza. I don't know if they still make them, but they used to. And you can paint that black with a black, get it black somehow with something that's not going to outgas, something that doesn't have a lot of chemicals in it that's going to absorb into your food. You can even paint it black and then put plastic wrap over the top and then put something like this on top.
So when you use that plastic top, do you have to poke holes in it?
They already have holes in them.
Okay.
Because they want the steam to vent out the top. So it's already there for you. This
so
one,
if you weren't using something that had holes, you would need to poke holes in it to let the
steam out. Absolutely, because you want the moisture to come out. If the moisture isn't coming out, then you're not dehydrating. This one has the hole right here. There used to be a cute little vent thing on there. I just took it off because I never used it. And I want to quickly share my screen and show you. We've mentioned the sun oven a couple of times. So people who don't know what those are, I'm going to show you what that is. So this is a sun oven. They get very hot. They can get up to 350, 400 degrees. So you can actually cook beans and rice and all sorts of great stuff in here besides meat. You can also get a kit to dehydrate in these sun ovens. BJ, have you ever done that? I think Christy probably has.
Yeah, I've got the kit, but I haven't done it in there because I've got the bigger one.
Right. I do know that you have to, instead of locking the glass down, that as you would do when you're cooking in the sun oven, you have to leave it propped open again to let it, the moisture out.
Any advice or thoughts on drying meat?
Follow the recipe. Absolutely follow the recipe. Even the beef jerky that you buy in the store, once you open that package, you now need to refrigerate that meat. It says on the packages, refrigerate after opening. And lots of us don't see that. I've not dehydrated meat. My son's father has jerked beef in and other meat, wild game, in his oven. So it can be done. But find those recipes that are scientifically shown to be safe. And we might be able to find some of those for you and get them to you, Karen, if you want to get it out to the group.
Great. Any other questions on drying and dehydrating that I missed before we move on to fermenting and pickling? Okay. So one question we had about was the difference between pickling and fermenting. And I've brought Becca in here too, if she wants to talk about this. Anybody want to take first pass at the difference between pickling and fermenting? And I understand sometimes you can do either way with the same thing. What would be involved in that?
Do you want me to answer?
Well, go ahead, Becca, if you want to.
Yeah.
And then everybody can chime in.
Pickling can either be fermented, traditionally it was, or in more modern times, it's more usually acidified, which means you're adding something like vinegar, some form of acid to it. In the case of fermentation, it's building up its own acid in the process of the fermentation. And I think the person asking the question had asked something about canning, if I remember right. So you can can either one. you can can acidified pickles in a water bath canner because they're high acid. You can fermented pickles, but then it does stop the fermentation and it kills the good live bacteria, but it does keep them more as they are longer. Like you keep more the same texture and flavor, and it doesn't, when you put it in the fridge, it actually does continue fermenting just much, much more slowly. So if you have something in the back of your fridge for a few years, it is going to get softer and, you know, it's going to change. So if you can, it stops that process.
So for people who don't know about fermentation, talk a little bit about what you see as the benefits, and particularly the bacteria issues with fermenting.
Yeah. So if you ferment something, and was it Cynthia, I think, who described it? So you can either add a saltwater brine or you can salt it and press it. And there are ways to do it with less or no salt, but it's a little more complicated. The simplest way is to add salt dry or salt and water. It creates an environment in which the good bacteria thrive and the bad bacteria don't. And the good bacteria produce acid. So within a few days, the pH will drop to 4.6, which had been mentioned earlier as that safety threshold, and keep dropping, and it'll often get quite a bit more acidic than that. And I've actually, when I had a fermentation business, I used to chart that assiduously all the time, you know, use pH meters every day and chart it. And that's what I needed to produce to the food safety inspectors. Yeah, use strips or different kinds of testing methods.
I just went to get the testing strips because the woman who trained us for the master food preserver, I asked her about canning my kimchi, and I absolutely can as long as the pH is correct. You can always do it in a pressure canner, but then you're really damaging the whole process even more so than if you do a water bath.
Yeah, because it's even higher heat, right? And pressure. Yeah, in general, you want to make sure that the fermentation has gotten to 4.6 pH or lower. It's not finished if it isn't there, basically, and it's not safe.
Yeah. Now, there's some pickles that you don't want the acidic to come up. Sweet pickles quite often will be fermented before they go through the actual spicing them and stuff, so that they've got the proper acidity without the bitterness, without the acid taste. So sweet pickles is the only one that I've ever done any fermenting on as myself.
Can you can kombucha? That I don't know. Rebecca, do you know?
I'm sure you could, but I a lot of the benefit of kombucha is those live cultures.
And you kill it when you can it, right?
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. That's what I thought.
And pressure kill it. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Got it.
I got my pH strips from Amazon because I started all of this during the pandemic and nobody was going out. And so they delivered it right to the house. And I think it was like $8 for 100 strips, something like that. So not bad. I don't know. I suspect that you could get these in Tucson at any kind of store that sells restaurant supplies. Other than that, you can order them online. If you're not a fan of Amazon, I'm sure other places that sell restaurant supplies that specialize in fermentation supplies, I suspect you could get it from there as well.
Are they food preserving specific pH strips, or if we have pH strips we use for other things, is it the same?
As far as I know, they're the same. Rebecca had a, or a brew store, maybe a brew, somebody where you're buying stuff for brewing, beer or wine or such. Yeah. These are universal pH strips in the solution you want to measure. So yeah, these are just in the solution. They should all be the same, unless I did do a lot of research to make sure that I was getting some that I could use with food, because not all are food grade, and you don't want to stick things in your food that's not food grade.
Great. Thank you, everyone. Any other questions we had about fermenting or pickling? I'll just say pickling is a really good, easy way to get started. If you haven't done any of this, I think pickling is one of the easiest things to start with. Yeah. So moving on to canning, we have a lot of questions about canning. And I'm wondering, BJ, to start with, for people, we have some people watching who haven't canned at all. I'm wondering if you could just walk through the basic steps of canning with kind of approximate timeframes and the just at a high level, not to teach somebody to do it, but just so that they know what it looks like. What's the difference between water bath canning and pressure canning, equipment-wise and time-wise?
Okay. The first thing was the water bath canning, which is the most common, and that's a big, usually black pot that's got a rack inside of it, because you don't want your jars to be sitting on the very bottom. That's the primary thing, either pressure canning or water bath canning. You never want the jars to be sitting right on the bottom, because as it's heating up and boiling, it'll crack your jars, bounce them around a little bit too much. They have a rack at the bottom, and with boiling water baths, you cover the jars, usually about 1 inch to 2 inches above the top of the jar, and it boils for a specified amount of time. You start your timing when it comes to a boil after you've put your jars in, and you have to make sure that you're, the most common mistake with both pressure canning and water bath canning is having too high a heat. You want it to be at a boil, but you don't want it to be at a roaring boil, or it does what they call, where the water actually disappears out of the inside of your jar, and you'll have the food in there. It'll be canned, but there won't be any liquid left. So you don't want it to go that high, but you want it to be hot. Exactly. That's the rack at the bottom of the boiling water bath. And you'll want the water to get over the top of the jars after the lids are on, and so that the whole jar is actually immersed. In the pressure canning, you just have a little bit of water in the bottom. The book for the pressure canner will tell you how much water. Some of them at maybe 1 inch. Some of it tells you a quantity. The one that I just got recently tells you put 2.5 quarts of water in the bottom. And so that the manufacturer will tell you that, how much water you put in the bottom. And the pressure canner will bring the internal temperature up much, much higher than the boiling water bath, because you are using pressure. And that's a pressure canner on the side there. And they both seal. You want them to cool off slowly. Yeah, with the pressure canning, you want it to cool down at its own rate. You don't try to cool the pressure canner off at faster than what it just naturally cools off. I've seen people and heard people take it, and they're impatient to get their jars out because they're going someplace. So they put it under cold water and in the tap, and that doesn't work. It hasn't completely sealed it. It hasn't done everything but the pressure canning that needs to be done, because there's still some cooking going on for a couple hours afterwards. So you need to keep that in mind, that you don't try to cool it off too fast. Again, you don't want it to boil too high, and that's where your danger usually comes. With the pressure canners, if you keep the heat on high, it doesn't can it any faster. You need to keep it down so that if you've got a gauge on it, it stays right on the pounds of pressure that you need. And if it's got the little rocker, and it was kind of fun at the class that Cynthia and I took, said, how do you know when the rocker is at the right thing? And it was kind of, well, just kind of, he hear it. It goes instead of just rocking like crazy. What else could it help with?
Well, that's good. And just to clarify, for pressure canning, you need a pressure canner. It's a specific right. piece of equipment. So somebody, and I know we always get the question, can you do it in an Instapot? No, not for pressure canning. Now the water bath canning, you know, you can do it in any big pan that's big enough to put a rack in your jars and enough water over it that it can boil and you can use anything. So, but the pressure canner is a very specific piece of equipment, and that's for the food safety, because it's, again, just reiterating, it's things that are low acid or low sugar, right?
And there is a difference between a pressure canner and a pressure cooker, not just the stovetop ones. You could have a pressure cooker that will not can.
Right. Good point. Good point.
If you bought a pressure cooker that says it can do canning for you, I did that early on, 3-4 years ago. Then I did some research and found out that no, you cannot do pressure canning, but it can act as a water bath canner for you, but not for high acid, like jams and jellies and things. It can, anything you can do in a water bath, you can do in that pressure cooker, that electric pressure cooker. But as we've already mentioned, and maybe we're saying it a lot because it's really important, those Instapots and other types of pressure cookers are not for high pressure canning.
Right, okay. I have a question about sterilizing jars, because I've always sterilized jars and been taught that. And I think I saw something from you all that said, maybe you don't always have to sterilize jars when you water bath can. So tell me about that.
Do you want that one, Cynthia, or do you want me to?
Either one. It was news to me too. When we took our class, if you have brand new jars just out of the package, they are already sterilized. So we do not need to boil them. Now we need to bring them up to warm temperature so they don't crack when we put hot things in them, but they do not need to be sterilized if they're brand new out of the package. Now, BJ, do you remember if that was just for high acid foods, or was it also pressure canned foods?
That was for everything. Yeah. And if you've washed your dishes, your jars, your used jars in the dishwasher on a high temperature, they are sterilized again, as long as you wash them right before you use them. If you just washed them and then just stuck them on a shelf with the tops open, then you'll of course need to do something, but no, you don't have to.
Good to know. Well, that could save some time. Caramel. Can you water bath can caramel because it's high sugar? Anybody know?
I don't know.
I don't either.
We can look it up later.
Yeah, I can email the woman who trained us. She does research in the canning process and home canning process, and she's one of the foremost experts in the country. In fact, Presto went to her when they made their new electric canner, pressure canner, to do the research. So I can email her and find out.
Cool. And then I wonder if you want to talk about tomatoes, and there's been a lot of talk recently about newer varieties of tomatoes that are low acid enough that people are concerned about water bath canning them. And I mean, I guess testing pH is the answer for that, but I would imagine adding vinegar, like in salsa, it usually has vinegar anyway. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, they do plan for the newer, less acidic in your newer recipes, and you can add like citric acid, which is in a container, lemon juice or vinegar, and your recipes will tell you how much to add for tomatoes. And there has been some question as to the yellow tomatoes are so low acidic that it's recommended that you don't even try to can them unless you pressure can them, because you'd have half half of your fluid would be vinegar, and then you would taste the vinegar or whatever. But it's an add-in thing.
Thank you. I see a question about, will this recording be archived for future access? And the answer to that is yes. And in fact, all of our past webinars also have been recorded and archived. So if you're new to this group and you want to check out some of our previous sessions, it's eatlocalcochise.org /webinars are the archives, and /events is the sign up for upcoming events. And we had a question about how often we do these. We've been doing them every 2 weeks, and that's currently scheduled through the end of June. And if you want to get on our emailing list, when you sign up for a new webinar, there's a place where you can say, I want more information, and we'll send you updates, or just stick your email in the chat if you're comfortable, or just message us and let us know. We also have email, and we're on Facebook if you want to talk about something particular. So I see a question about recipes and directions for water bath canning, and Cynthia put a link, but I'm also going to put a whole page of specific recipe books for water bath canning that all of which are available free through the library. So we will share that as well.
You can print as much from that link as you'd like that I send. It's all free.
Great.
I did see someone ask about, do we have to blanch vegetables before freezing? We don't, but BJ, do you want to explain more? Because you're more experienced than I.
There's actually only a few vegetables that you don't need to blanch. Bell peppers is one, and onions is another one that you can cut up, flash freeze them, and you get the same results as if you'd blanched them without loss of the flavor. But for the most part, you do need to blanch them. And the recipe books will tell you which ones you can and can't get away with. I've tried in the past to think, well, I'm going to see what happens if I just flash freeze these peas. And if you don't mind eating rubber, they were fine, but they were very tough afterwards. They needed to stop the growing process with the blanching. And that seemed to be the big thing on that, is it stops the growing process, because they'll continue to have whatever it is that makes them grow still alive in freezing.
So it's a flavor and consistency issue, not a food safety issue.
Pretty much.
Yeah. Okay.
You'll also lose nutrition and texture. Mm-hmm.
I know a lot of people who freeze whole tomatoes without blanching.
Right. I've heard that too. And peaches. I've heard peaches go in. They come out looking like a frozen ball, and I guess they're okay to put in pies and stuff. I've never tried that. Yeah.
Berries, we always freeze those just fresh whole. And they're fine.
Right. Fruits are a little bit different.
Yeah.
But your vegetables, most of the vegetables need to be blanched.
And for anything that you want to be able to use separated, whether it's blanched or raw, if you spread it out on a big sheet cake pan to freeze it, and then once it's frozen, gathered up and put in a plastic bag, that way you don't end up with a giant mass of frozen stuff for people who are new to this. That's something I learned.
Great way to do it. I see that we have conversations about freezing in jars. You can freeze in certain jars. Now you want to make sure the jar is the straight up and down. See how this one kind of has shoulders and it curves up? That is likely to break in your freezer. These are created to use in your freezer. There's actually a line on the jar that says freeze line, meaning don't fill it past this line. And I've used these for soups that I freeze and then I take it to work. And I've done that for about 8 years now, since I learned that you can do that.
I Excellent. So we are getting close to the top of the hour. So if I missed any questions, let me know, but I'm gonna share my screen again and just wrap up with a couple things. These are some of the books that are available through our county library system. And if you're new to the county library system, you can request any of these books from any branch. And we have 12 county branches and city libraries that collaborate, and they can get the book delivered to your branch. So if you're interested in books on fermenting, canning, drying, generally preserving food at home, just check at your library. And there are a lot of really great books out there. If you want to look at the list yourself, cocheeselibrary.org is our library website. And again, that's for the books throughout the county. And some of our libraries are opening up again, but all of our libraries have curbside service and have for some time. And then I just want to talk about a couple other upcoming events. I mentioned we're doing a countywide big read of Animal Vegetable Miracle by Barbara Kingsolver. If you haven't read that book, it's just a lovely book. She is a gifted writer and has a lot of good information about preserving food, but also just in general, growing food and eating local and the benefits. And we invite you to read that on your own time or with a group. If you're in a book club or if you're in another group who might want to read that together, our library system has book club kits that have about, you know, a dozen copies of the book that you could check out. And then we also have multiple copies of that book at all of our branches. At the end of June, we'll be doing an online book club discussion of that book. And then 2 weeks from today, on June 2nd, BJ is going to be back with us and joined by Christy Brown, also from BASA, to talk about desert foraging. So we're excited about that. On June 3rd, we will have a table at the Sierra Vista Farmers Market if you want to stop by and say hi. And then on June 16th, we have a couple local ranchers joining us to talk about raising local livestock and where you can get local meat and the advantages of local meat and how they grow and what their process is. As we're wrapping up, if you have a couple minutes, we would love it if you could fill out the evaluation. I just put a link in the chat, and that's helpful to our funders to know what we're doing. And as I mentioned, there's a lot of information on our website. You're welcome to email us, and if you have any follow-up questions from today, and we are also on Facebook and Instagram. So thank you so much, Cynthia and BJ, for being with us here tonight. And thanks, everybody. Any closing thoughts from our panelists before we sign off?
Thank you all for being here this evening, taking time away from your family and your lives to listen to us chat with you, and lots of really wonderful questions. I am putting my email in the chat in case anybody has any other questions about canning. If I don't have the answer, I will find the answer for you, either through the woman who trained me and BJ, or I'll go straight to BJ or Christy Brown, or maybe Rebecca.
Great. Thank you all so much, and we will see you again in 2 weeks.
Thank you.
Good night, everybody.